So you were David's father, and he was your only son. And the new cut peats are rotting, and the work is left undone because of an old man weeping. Just an old man in pain. For David, his son, David, that will not come again. Oh, the letters he wrote you, and I can see them still. Not a word of the fighting, but just the sheep on the hill. And how you should get the crops in ere the year gets stormier. And the Boches have got his body, and I was his officer. You were only David's father, but I had 50 sons. When we went up in the evening under the arch of the guns, and we came back at twilight, oh God, I heard them call to me for help and pity that could not help at all. Oh, never will I forget you, my men that trusted me, more my sons than your fathers, for they could only see the little helpless babies and the young men in their pride. They could not see you dying and hold you while you died. Happy and young and gallant, they saw their firstborn go, but not the strong limbs broken and the beautiful men brought low. The piteous, writhing bodies, they screamed, "Don't leave me, sir," for they were only your fathers, but I was your officer.
These were the words, a poem written by an officer called Ewart Allan McIntosh, and he called it In Memoriam. On the evening of the 16th of May 1916, McIntosh and 2nd Lieutenant Mackay of the 5th Battalion of the Seaforth Highlanders led a raid on the German trenches in an area northwest of Arras. What they experienced that night had a profound effect on McIntosh. Battalion War Diary gives us a little bit of information. It says, the battalion was employed in working parties. In the evening at 8:10, after an artillery preparation, two raiding parties under McIntosh and Mackay entered German lines on both sides of a salient. Seven Germans were killed while being either shot or bayoneted, and five dugouts full of Germans were bombed. Also, one dugout was blown up by Royal Engineers. All of our party returned except one man who was left dead in German lines. It is estimated that German casualties must have been between 60 and 70. Our casualties were 2nd Lieutenant Mackay wounded, two men killed and 14 wounded, and two of the wounded have since died. We now know that the two soldiers from the battalion that were killed in this raid were Privates John McDowell and David Sutherland. McDowell's body was retrieved and he's buried in a nearby British cemetery, Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery. But Sutherland was never found and he's remembered on the Arras Memorial. And the reason that I wanted to play that poem was because McIntosh has written that poem to Sutherland's father, and he's talking directly to his father about his son David. Perhaps David was the man that was left dead in the German lines, as he says in the poem. And he talks about the Boche have got his body. Maybe the Germans buried him in a marked grave, but of course we don't know where that is now. We don't know the exact relationship between McIntosh and Private Sutherland, but it looks as though McIntosh was his commanding officer. And of course he would have read Private Sutherland's letters to his dad as part of the censorship that went on at that time. Indeed, McIntosh talks about what he'd read when he was censoring these letters. Not a word of the fighting, just the sheep on the hill. David Sutherland was just 19 when he died. So what's the relevance of this for this podcast? Well, in this podcast, I wanted to talk about the relationship between father and son in the Great War, And I've uncovered some stories about father and sons being killed in the Great War. Obviously, this wasn't as common as brothers being killed because of the age difference between fathers and sons. But we've got quite a few and some famous ones as well. And why am I doing this? Well, I think back unashamedly to my own dad and his influence on me and my interest in the Great War. And as I said in the very first podcast that I recorded, it all started for me, the interest, when my dad was standing in front of the TV on Remembrance Sunday, standing saluting the black and white television. It's that memory that stuck with me all of these years and what made me want to get more involved in the research and the remembrance of the Great War. And later on in life, we started to watch war films with my dad, and the journey ended. I sit here now looking at a photograph of my dad sitting on a bench at the Lough Neagh crater. I don't know when this photo was taken. It must be probably 15 years ago now. He died in 2012, so this was probably 3 or 4 years before that. And it gone full circle. He first took me to the Menin Gate in 1980, and then I took him back to the Somme to finish that journey on the last day that he ever went abroad. And it created, if it needed to create, that bond between me and my dad, which death can't take away. Nothing can take that away, not until the day that I die. And I know that many people listening to this podcast all over the world will feel the same way. They'll feel that their dad created that spark, created that interest, and told them perhaps about a great uncle or their granddad, or maybe their own living memory of the Great War. There's still some people alive today whose dad would have fought in the Great War. And I wanted to dedicate this podcast to all of those fathers that served and maybe died or were horrendously wounded and their lives changed forever on the Western Front and beyond. And to do that, of course, we're going to look into the words, into the eyes of those soldiers that were there. And we've started with that poem that was beautifully read there by the actor Danny Dyer. So as usual in this podcast, we're not necessarily going to talk about the battles of the Great War, but we're going to look at the individuals that fought in those battles and the relationship between the father and son. In some cases, we're going to be talking about a father and son that died on the battlefield, and in one case, a famous story from Tynecott, we're going to talk about a father who tried to get aid for his dying son and in the process was killed himself. We're going to look at the story of a Canadian chaplain who tried to find, and eventually did find, the grave of his son on the Somme battlefield. And there's quite a well-known story of a father and son that are buried next to each other on a Somme cemetery, a place that we usually visit when we go on Terry's tours to the battlefield. But what I wanted to do to start with was look at a story of a Canadian father and son, and whose relationship after the death of the boy caused the father to go to extreme measures to try and repatriate his son's body to Canada. And he even tested really the rule of law and the rules of the what was then called the Imperial War Graves Commission to try and get his son repatriated. Let's look at that story to start with. And to do this, I've used the archives of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, which are online. There's thousands of documents that are online. All you've got to do is go to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, look for the archives, and then use their search engine to search for what you're looking for. And I was just browsing through it a few days ago, looking for some interesting stories to tell, and I came across this one. Now, initially, the story of Private Granville Carson Hopkins is tragically a story that's not untypical of the Battle of Passchendaele, Third Battle of Ypres, in the autumn of 1917. He was one of many Canadians that was killed in action whilst trying to take the village of Passchendaele, just in front of the village of Passchendaele, not far from Tynecott. He enlisted with the 196th Canadian Battalion in April of 1917, and he was from a town, I've got to pronounce this right, called Saskatoon, Saskatoon, and on the 2nd of June 1917, Hopkins left Halifax in Canada, and they disembarked in Liverpool a week later. And then he was transferred to the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, the Princess Pats as they became known. On the 2nd of November 1917, Hopkins joined his unit in the field, along with 44 other ranks. But less than 2 weeks later, Hopkins was killed on his first day in action, which was the 15th of November 1917. In the newspaper back home, his death was reported. It says, news has reached the city of the death of Private Grenville Carson Hopkins while serving in the trenches with the Princess Pats. The young soldier, who was 21 years of age, is the son of the ex-Mayor and Mrs. William Hopkins, who were on their way to California to spend the winter when they're informed of the death. The telegram from the records office was sent to Winnipeg to intercept them, and it was there the parents learned of their loss. Private Hopkins was a student in the College of Arts and Science when he enlisted and completed his second year. And there's even a report in the record that tells us that he was buried between the church and the nearest pillbox at Passchendaele, and his grave was marked by a rifle placed in the ground with the bayonet upward. And the record gives us horrific details of actually how he died. It says he was with his battalion in the support lines during the Passchendaele operations, and information is available that on the morning of the 15th, he was hit by an enemy shell and had part of his head taken off whilst taking cover in a shell hole, and the death was instantaneous. What happened then was, as happened with so many, his body was found in 1920 and he was buried alongside a Private Louis James McEwen in Tynecott Cemetery. And they were buried in plot 56, row A, grave 1 and 2 respectively. And there really the story should end, but that's when his powerful and wealthy father got involved and tried, and indeed did, exhume the body of his son. So the story starts actually in December 1920, when Mr. and Mrs. Hopkins came over from Canada, and actually, unusually, because they were a family of means, were able to attend the funeral, the burial, or the reburial of their son in Tynecott Cemetery. In the months before, Mr. Hopkins had even taken part in the search for his son's body. He went back to Canada, having been unsuccessful, but then when the body was found, he returned with his wife to attend the funeral. And then in May 1921, the parents returned to Tynecott, and they mentioned to the people there that they were going to obtain permission to remove the body to Canada. Now, permission was quickly refused, so what they then did was rather underhand. They enlisted the help of a man called Colonel Causton. He was a demobilised British officer that was still in Belgium, and it seems that Causton had tried to help other people exhume and repatriate their human remains. And that's exactly what happened, because on the night of the 17th and the 18th of May 1921, the body of Private Hopkins was removed from Tynecott Cemetery. This was discovered in the following morning by one of the gardeners. What they actually did was rather crude. The coffin had been wrenched open, the body taken out, and the coffin was actually left in the grave. The remains by this time, of course, consisted of just bones. There was no human flesh left. So they must have just scooped up the bones and put them in some kind of container. Wouldn't have needed to have been very big, of course. As you probably know, it was decided early on that soldiers that died abroad would be buried abroad or remembered abroad, and that each soldier would be treated equally in death. It would be unfair to allow repatriations of some soldiers, because that wouldn't be treating soldiers equally in death, would it? Because if you're a poor family, you wouldn't have the financial means to be able to do this. And this was explained to Mr. and Mrs. Hopkins in one of the letters from the commission. It said the policy of non-repatriation of Commonwealth war casualties still applies, and it ensures that all those who died together are buried together, irrespective of how wealthy or influential their families were or when they were buried. As we know, Hopkins Sr. had been the mayor of his town, and he was influential in high places, and he even got the Prime Minister of Canada involved. And the commission, it was still going on in October 1921, after Hopkins had been reburied, and the commission was getting quite frustrated with Mr. Hopkins. And in the letter to the government, the commission explained that the result of acceding to his request would be very far-reaching. The policy of prohibition is in line with the policy of absolute equality of treatment in marking the graves and in all other respects, irrespective of wealth and rank. If permission is granted to the rich to remove bodies at their own expense, it will eventually lead to a demand for the removal of bodies of the poor, or perhaps all bodies, at government expense. They go on to say, Mr. Hopkins has been at great expense, and perhaps in the circumstances it is regretted that he did not succeed in completing the enterprise. Unfortunately, the matter has now become official, and the situation is therefore a dangerous one. Quite damning words. Hopkins didn't give in there. There's pages, I think there's about 90 pages of correspondence in the commission's archives, and it went on actually until 1924 before the correspondence ended. And I mentioned that there was another body there, the Private McEwen, and the archives tell us that the remains of both soldiers were identified by Mr. Hopkins. McEwen, of course, is still buried in Tynecott Cemetery. I've got a photograph here of young Hopkins. He looks a very studious young man. He's wearing glasses. Looks, of course, very young. And I'll put a photograph of him on the podcast website, terrystours.co.uk. Now, once they discovered that the grave had been robbed effectively, the commission tracked down the body and found that it was in a mortuary in Antwerp. Hopkins and his cohort, Colston, were arranging for the body then to be shipped via the UK back to Canada. But the commission intervened and they arranged for his body to be buried in a cemetery in Antwerp. I would have thought it would have been returned to Tynecott, but it wasn't. It was buried in Antwerp. And there it remains to this day. And again, I've got a photograph of his grave there, looked after by the commission, with the Canadian maple leaf on the top there, with his details on there, and I'll put that photograph on the website as well. And then in 1930, the commission realised that Hopkins had got two crosses. He'd got one in Antwerp, and the original cross was still on his grave, his original grave in Tynecott. And there's a memo between two officers within the commission, dated the 1st of April 1930, and it says, may the cross stand into this man in Tynecott, plot 56, row A, grave 1, be removed and destroyed, and his name expunged from the records of this cemetery. This man's grave is in Schulerslop Cemetery, grave 77 in Antwerp. And that's what happened. So I've not been there. I've not been to see plot 56, row A, grave 1. But I would think that there's just a blank space there now. Grave 1, it's probably then at the end of a row or the start of a row. And next to it will be the grave of his comrade McEwen. And that's what I'll be doing next time I return to Tynecott. I'll be going to see what's actually there. What do I think about this in conclusion? Well, you've got to really appreciate how the family felt. Probably unfair of the man to try and use his power and influence. As I say, that the correspondence went on for several years, 3 or 4 years. And the commission, to their credit, stood firm on this. It really was an important one of the three values that they set out right in the beginning when the commission was established in 1917, that all of these bodies would be treated equally in death and there wouldn't be any repatriation. There had been some in the early stages of the war. There'd been a number of bodies before the war was brought into place that had been repatriated to the UK. But they stood firm on this, and they had to, really. Imagine the chaos if they hadn't. Imagine what it would have been like going to visit these cemeteries now. You'd have seen all sorts of gaps in the rows, the beautiful rows in the beautiful cemeteries, and would have been telling all sorts of different stories and what would have happened to these bodies once they got them home. You know, they wouldn't have had Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstones. Would they still be remembered now? It's difficult, isn't it? It's 100 years on. We don't know how those families felt at the time, but my gut feeling is the commission made the right decision. So let's now look at this unusual story, unusual in that We have a father and son that died on the same day and are buried next to each other in a place called Dartmoor Cemetery near Becor, just behind the British front lines at the 1st of July 1916. 19-year-old Robert was already a serving soldier when war was declared, and he arrived on the Western Front in August 1914. His father, George, was the landlord of a pub in Dulwich in London, and in early 1915 he volunteered. On the 12th of December 1915, George arrived on the Western Front, and on the 15th of July 1916, George marched through the ruins of Fricourt just after dawn. And 2 days later, his unit was in a field close to Mametz Wood, and they began firing on the enemy that at that stage were in High Wood. On the 23rd of July, his unit were ordered to aim their fire at the German back areas and the approaches to the front. But of course, what did the Germans do in this situation? They retaliate, and the counter barrage was immense. In early August, the 156th Brigade received 81 replacements. This is the Royal Field Artillery. And it needed to bring them back up to strength following these July battles. And amongst the reinforcements was Robert. So now the father and son would fight together. And for the remainder of that month in August, there were sporadic flurries of counter-battery fire from the enemy. And their own battery encountered problems with their guns being used constantly without ongoing maintenance taking place. And of course, they then broke down. At the beginning of September, the brigade was based in Caterpillar Valley. And here, life for an artilleryman was extremely dangerous. And unfortunately, that's how it proved to be for these two men. On the 5th of September, four men within their battery were killed instantly by shell fire. And sadly, two of those were the father and son, George and Robert. And as I say, if you go to Dartmoor Cemetery, there's a number of notable graves in there. There's a Victoria Cross winner. There's a man that was shot at dawn. There's even a man called Henry Webber, who is, as far as we know, the oldest man to be commemorated by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. I think he was 68 years old, something like that. So it's definitely worth going to the back of the cemetery where the wall is at the back. In plot one, graves A35 and 36, you'll find the father and son, George and Robert Lee. This next story concerns a man from Northampton, my hometown, and he was killed in September 1914 during the Battle of the Aisne in the first few weeks of the Great War. And his story has a connection with his son, who died in the Second World War. His son was born just 5 days after the soldier in question died. And usually in these circumstances, or quite often, the mother would then give the baby the name of his father. But in this case, she gave the baby the name of its father's commanding officer who died with him. Let's look at the newspaper articles that were printed at the time about this man. And his name was Sergeant Bertram Pask, 1st Battalion Northamptonshire Regiment, who died on the 16th of September 1914. The local paper reported, "Killed in action, local heroes who have fallen, a good and brave soldier." Sergeant Pask of the 1st North Ants is unofficially reported as having been killed. His wife lives at 26 Adelaide Street, later received a letter from Mrs. Osborne Smith, the wife of the colonel of the battalion, stating that Pask, who she describes as a good and brave soldier, was killed in the Battle of the Aisne. Pask was 35 years old, was a gymnastic instructor to the battalion, was a fine athlete, having won many prizes on the running path during the 13 years he'd spent in India. He comes from a soldier family. His father and great-grandfather served in the army, and his father-in-law is also a soldier. Much sympathy is to be felt with Mrs. Pask, who has 5 children. And we have another article here which says, "The baby, which was born about the time his father died, has received the name of Gordon Mons Aisne, the first name being in memory of the sergeant's company officer, Captain Gordon, who died on the same day." You can see the first name named after that officer, and the next two names named after Mons and Aisne, the two battles that these two soldiers would have fought in those early weeks of the Great War in 1914. Mrs. Pask was also informed that they lie buried together side by side. And it says that Mrs. Pask's health was in a critical condition, having given birth, and the news of her father's death was held from her until her baby was a few days old. The baby's now 5 weeks old. He's essentially a war baby. The added tragedy is here that neither of those soldiers have a known grave. Their graves were lost and they're now remembered on the Lerfurt Sus Jorol, I think, memorial. I have no idea how you pronounce that. I'm sure I haven't got it right. But it's basically the memorial in France that remembers the men that died in those early months of the Great War in the summer and autumn of 1914. Now, father and son, this podcast is all about what happened to that young man, Gordon Mons Ane Pask. Well, here comes the double tragedy, because he served in the Second World War. He was serving with the Royal Navy on board a ship called the Caspia, and on the 16th of April 1942, the Caspia was sailing south of Beirut when a U-boat fired two torpedoes, and one of the torpedoes hit the ship in the bow. The tanker sank in flames 10 miles south of Beirut, and 20 minutes after the torpedo hit the boat, it was given a coup de grace by the U-boat, and it sank to the bottom of the ocean. The master, 22 crew members and two gunners were lost, and Gordon, tragically, was one of those who went down with his ship. He has no known grave, and he's remembered on the Tower Hill Memorial. What a double tragedy then that is. I'm not sure where the wife was at this stage, whether she was still alive, I haven't looked. But she's lost her husband in the First World War. Young Gordon never knew his father, but no doubt his father would have been in his mind when he joined up to serve in the Second World War, and he's killed as well. And neither father nor son have a known grave. They're both remembered on memorials to the missing. So for this next story, let's go up to Tynecott, a place that we've been to already in this podcast and in other podcasts. But we're not going to go in the cemetery this time. We're going to go to the curved wall, the memorial to the missing, along the back of the cemetery. And between panels 108 and 111, you'll find entries on the wall of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, the Coilies. And here you'll find a father and son. As far as we know, these are the only father and son combination to have died in the third battle of Ypres, the Battle of Passchendaele. In 1914, Harry Morehouse and his son Ronald both joined the army. They were posted to originally the 4th Battalion of the Coilies in the 49th Division. And even though Harry was wounded twice, he kept returning to his unit. And on the 9th of October 1917, the battalion was part of the Divisional Reserve, and by this time Harry was in command of the battalion with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. On the 7th of October, the battalion received its orders for the attack, which was to take place on the 9th. This we now know to be called the Battle of Pau Capelle within the overall Battle of Passchendaele. At 12:15 a.m, Morehouse led his battalion. They moved up to the old German front line, known as Banks Farm, to the assembly position. The night was very dark, the track was in bad repair, and the progress that they made was consequently very slow. Before they could move up to their assembly positions, the Germans put down a heavy barrage on the ridge, and they had to cross it. It caused delays, and there were numerous casualties. Don't forget, this is October 1917. This is when the rains had come to the Passchendaele battlefield, turning that battlefield into the quagmire that we see in those photos, and it's widely regarded as the worst experience that any British or Commonwealth soldiers ever experienced. This is what this father and son combination had to face on the day that they died. Now, as you can imagine, when the 49th Division, which they were part of, went over the top that day, they were held up by heavy fire, and the 4th Coilies were ordered to go forward in support. Ronald was now a captain in his father's battalion. He advanced with his company to their first objective. They advanced up this long slope and they came under fire from German strong points in a place called Wolf Copse and on the Bellevue Ridge. Ronald was leading his men and unfortunately he was wounded. His father, Harry, got news that his son had been wounded and he left his headquarters post. He went to try and find his son and find medical help, but whilst he was doing so, he was shot dead by a sniper. The attack broke down, the troops were forced to return to their original starting positions, and those two men, the father and sons, Harry and Ronald, they're still out there somewhere, probably, unless they're beneath one of those headstones that says known unto God, because neither of them have a grave, and their names, in rank order of course, are close to each other on the Tynecock Memorial. There was one message that was sent back to the family by one of their colleagues, one of their comrades, and it says, "I'm sorry to have to tell you that Major Morehouse has been killed and he died in my arms." Now, as you can understand, back home, Harry's wife, Ronald's mother, she was called Susanna, she was utterly devastated, and like many families, this hung over the family for many, many generations, and probably still does today. They're the lyrics of James Blunt talking about the relationship with his own father. When the war came to an end in 1918, there was a family home, number 55 Well Street, Fenton, Stoke-on-Trent, and there were to be two empty chairs at the dining room table, two empty spaces for Sunday dinner. Two men, both called William, father and son, William Thomas Evans, the head of the household, and his eldest son, William Henry. William Sr. was a coal miner, and he'd wrestled with his conscience for almost 2 months after the start of the war before he decided to leave home and join the fight. He wanted to do his duty, but he was the main breadwinner for his wife Harriet, and eight of their nine children who were living at home. And he went off to Gallipoli with the 7th Battalion of the North Staffordshire Regiment. Now, as listeners to this podcast will probably know, the Gallipoli campaign was a complete disaster. And in January 1916, it was decided to evacuate the peninsula. But unfortunately, it would be too late for William. At 11:15 a.m. on January the 7th, 1916, there was a violent bombardment. It shook their trenches. Soldiers and officers ducked for cover, sheltered in dugouts or against the trench walls as the hail of hot metal rained down from above. Imagine the scene as the shrapnel ripped into these unfortunate soldiers. This bombardment went on for nearly 5 hours, and then at 4:15 p.m. the Turkish infantry attacked, yelling as they came across no man's land. The North Staffords, they stood at their posts to meet the attackers, showing great discipline. The Turks, who knows, did they know that the British enemy was preparing to leave Gallipoli when they made this last attack? They soon gave up their attack and they retreated in the face of the fire from the Staffordshire lads. The very next day, the North Staffordshires who'd survived the fighting got on a transport ship. They left Gallipoli far behind. They left behind their commanding officers, Lieutenant Colonel Francis Hercules Walker. He'd been killed in the last attack, and killed alongside him were 34 soldiers, and in amongst them was the Corporal William Thomas Evans. His body, like so many of them, was never found. He was 39 years old, and he's remembered on the Hellers Memorial. His youngest daughter, Ida, she was not yet 2 years old, and she grew up without a memory of her father like so many others. And by the time news reached home that William Sr. had been killed, his eldest son was already preparing to go to war. And William Jr. joined the 2nd Battalion of the Lincolnshire Regiment, and he was 21 years old when he took part in the final 100 Days Offensive. And on the 8th of October 1918, during that final offensive, the battalion succeeded in advancing some 6,000 yards forward across what was now open ground. And during the day, they were responsible for mopping up a number of woods and farms where the Germans were still holding. There was no doubt a lot of close quarter fighting. And according to the battalion diary, the Lincolnshires did their work splendidly, the spirit of the men being good throughout. But somewhere along the line, young William was killed as well. And just like his father, he has no known grave. And he's remembered on the Vizan Artois Memorial. So we now move on to tell the story of a father and son combination that were killed on the same day, but a year apart. Captain Frederick Courtney Silios served in Africa with a unit called the 25th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers, the Frontiersmen. And in September 1916, Frederick was awarded the DSO for conspicuous gallantry, resource and endurance. His citation says, "He set a magnificent example to all ranks, and the value of his services with his battalion cannot be overestimated." But then in January 1917, the battalion was fighting on the banks of the Rufiji River against German colonial troops, and they were vastly outnumbered. And on the morning of the 4th of January, Frederick was creeping forward in combat when he raised his head in order to locate the enemy. He was shot in the head and killed instantly. Look in the battalion war diary. It says, "Marched out at 05:30 hours, engaged the enemy in dense bush at 10:30 on our right and front flank simultaneously and drove him from his position. Casualties obtained, killed Captain Celius, DSO, one NCO and two men. He was buried under a tree close to where he died." And this is now within a game reserve in a country that is now called Tanzania. Now, the other men that were killed in his action were graves were concentrated into a Commonwealth War Graves Commission nearby, but the Commission, Commonwealth War Graves Commission, have kindly agreed that this unusual war grave should be kept as it is, as it was, under that tree. And if you ever get to Tanzania, you'll be able to go and see the unusual grave in its original position. Now, his son, Frederick Hathley Bruce Silios, was born in 1898 in Berkshire, and he was educated at Rugby School. And he entered Sandhurst in September 1915, and when he left, he was gazetted into the Royal West Surrey Regiment and then attached to the Royal Flying Corps. After going through pilot training in July 1916, he was sent to the front, and he was awarded the Military Cross. And he returned to the UK in April 1917, and Frederick joined the Central Flying School as an instructor. After a few months as an instructor, in September 1917, he returned to operational duties with the No. 60 Squadron of the Royal Flying Corps, and he was credited with a victory over a German reconnaissance plane near Ypres in November 1917, and then on the 28th of December 1917, he was credited with another victory. But then on the 4th of January 1918, he's still only 19 years old, it's exactly a year after his father was killed, a report was received from a fellow pilot, a man called Lieutenant Edward Thornton, and he described what happened. He says, "I was up at 15,000 feet over the German lines when I saw Captain Silius take a dive at a German machine some 2,000 feet below. What actually happened, I do not know, but all at once I saw both wings of the machine collapse and he fell to earth like a stone. We were terribly upset at this, as he was idolised by us all." The commanding officer of the 60 Squadron, No. 60 Squadron, he wrote a letter of condolence to his mum. He said, "It's a severe blow to the squadron to lose him, for he was beloved by officers and men alike. In fact, his popularity extended to a much greater area than his own aerodrome. In a short time that I've known him, I've been struck with the courage and keenness of your son, always ready for his jobs and always going about his work with the cheeriest and happiest of smiles. He was the life and soul of the mess." Now, I found this information on the Western Front Association website, And the writer believes of this article that the Germans may have buried him in one of their own cemeteries southeast of Ypres. But after the war, the graves in that German cemetery were concentrated into the Perth Cemetery China Wall. But unfortunately, we don't know if Frederick is one of them. He may well be buried in that cemetery, but either way, he's remembered on the Royal Flying Corps Memorial within the Arras Cemetery. Can you only imagine what it must have been like at home on that day? The family would have been remembering Frederick Sr., who had died exactly a year ago, and as they're doing that, maybe raising a glass, a toast to him, notification comes through a few days later that the son, the young son, has also been killed, and worse than that, worse than ever, he has no known grave. There's no way of remembering him, not until that memorial was built some years after the war. How on earth do these families ever get over this? Beneath the Menin Gate, now of course covered in scaffolding, there are the names of a father and son from Wales. There is Private Reginald Pritchard, who was just 19 years old, and his father, Sergeant William Pritchard, who was 42 years old, and they died on the 2nd of May 1915. And this was during the Second Battle of Ypres, the battle that we've covered before, where the Germans first used gas, poison gas. Reginald Pritchard, like many soldiers, wrote regular letters back from the trenches, and he wrote to his sister. He says, "It's much worse fighting where we are now to what it was at the last place. One of the chaps out of the same section as I got wounded in the leg yesterday morning as we were leaving the trenches. One man got killed in our company by a trench mortar shell. He was in the same platoon as my dad." Both father and son were serving with the 3rd Battalion of the Monmouthshire Regiment. And as I say, they were both killed on the same day. Neither of them have a grave that we know of and are remembered on the Menin Gate beneath the scaffolding. And on that day, the 2nd of May 1915, the battalion had 89 casualties and only 3 of them have a known grave. Now, people always remember this battle, as I said earlier, for the gas that the Germans used. But in the area that the Monmouthshires were serving on the 2nd of May, it wasn't gas that was the problem. It was the German artillery. I've used a book that I've used before, Magnificent But Not War, The Second Battle of Ypres by John Dixon. And in there he describes what the battalion went through on that spring day. He says that the line was so heavily shelled that many of the soldiers believed it impossible to get any worse. The trenches were obliterated and the shelters collapsed. And he quotes a Sergeant A. Davies of the 3rd Monmouthshires. He wrote to his friends at home, giving details of one incident. Just listen to this and try and put yourself in the place of those Welshmen that were there that day, including, of course, Pritchard Senior and Junior. He says, "Our worst time started on May the 2nd, when they gave it to us a bit hot. It was on that day that Lance Corporal Reg Rumsey and Lance Corporal Taylor got buried by a shell bursting on top of the dugout. We managed to get them out after a bit of a struggle, and I think Ramsey acted splendidly. If it had not been for him, Taylor would have been dead. After getting his head and arms clear, he would not think of anything else but getting Taylor out. In fact, he set to at releasing him, and it was rather a good job. For when we got Taylor out, he was at his last gasp." So he's just about saved that man. And how many more men will we know? Nearly 100 men were killed in the shelling that day. Now, if you're ever on the Somme and you head down the Roman road, the D929, towards Albert, you'll see on the left-hand side, just before you get to Albert, there's the Ibis Hotel, which no doubt some of you have stayed in. Before you get to the Ibis Hotel, you'll pass, as most people usually do without stopping, Bapaume Post Military Cemetery. But it's worth stopping there next time you go. Park up in the lay-by, go inside the gate, turn right, go to plot 1, row E, grave 4, and you'll see the grave of a Canadian man, Captain Henry Hutton Scott. He was with the 87th Battalion of the Canadian Infantry when he was killed in action on the 21st of October 1916, aged 24 years old. But his father, Canon Frederick George Scott, was a senior chaplain working with the 1st Canadian Division in France a few months later, and he knew that his son had been killed in the fighting around the Regina Trench area, and he was determined that he was going to find his son's body, and that's exactly what he did. And he wrote a book after the war called The Great War As I Saw It, and in the book he describes that moment where he found his son's body. And don't forget, the Battle of the Somme is still going on when he visits this area in February of 1917, and this is what he said, quoting from his book: "I'd been warned that we were going to make a bombardment of the enemy lines that morning, and I ought to be out of the way before that began. I left the sergeant near Courcelette and made my way over to the brigade headquarters, which were in a dugout in Death Valley. There, with the permission of his OC, a runner volunteered to come with me. He brought a spade and we started down the trench to the front line. When I got into Regina Trench, I found that it was impossible to pass along, as one sank down so deeply into the heavy mud. I brought a little sketch with me of the trenches, which showed the shell hole where it was supposed that the body had been buried. The previous night, a cross had been placed there by a corporal of the battalion before it left the front line. No one I spoke to, however, could tell me the exact map location of the place where it stood. I looked over the trenches, and on all sides spread a waste of brown mud, made more desolate by the morning mist which clung over everything. I was determined, however, not to be baffled in my search, and I told the runner who was with me that if I stayed there 6 months, I was not going to leave until I found that grave. We walked back along the communication trench and turned into one on the right, peering over the top every now and again to see if we could recognise anything corresponding to the marks on our map. Suddenly the runner, who was looking over the top, pointed far away to a lonely white cross that stood at the point where the ground sloped down through the mist towards Regina Trench. At once we climbed out of the trench and made our way over the slippery ground to where the white cross stood in the middle, out in the solitude. We passed many bodies which were still unburied. When we came up to the cross, I read my son's name upon it and knew that I had reached the object I had in view. As the corporal who had placed the cross there had not been quite sure that he was actually on the place of burial, I got the runner to dig the ground in front of it. He did so, but we discovered nothing but a large piece of shell. Then I got him to try in another place, and still we could find nothing. I tried once again, and after he dug a little while, he came across something white. It was my son's left hand, with his signet ring upon it. They had removed his identification disc, revolver and pocketbook, so the signet ring was the only thing which could have led to his identification. It was really quite miraculous that we should make the discovery. The mist was lifting now, and the sun to the east was beginning to light up the ground. We heard the crack of bullets, for the Germans were sniping at us. I made the runner go down into a shell hole, where I read the burial service, and then took off the ring. He then goes on to say, on November the 24th, I received a telegram saying that a working party of one of the battalions had brought my son's body back, and so on the following day, I motored once again to Albert and laid my dear boy to rest in the little cemetery on the Tara Hill. So there we go, just a few stories that connect father and son, some killed on the battlefields, some other stories, but still explaining that special relationship that will last forever between father and son, whatever happens to them. And I know that from my own experience, and I'm sure many of you do too. So this week, I wanted to end the podcast by looking at one more story between father and son. And it's a famous story. I'm not going to go into it in great detail because you'll probably know it, but it's the story of Rudyard Kipling and his boy, my boy Jack, John Kipling, as he was known. He, of course, would have spent the rest of his life regretting that he pulled in favours within the British establishment to get his son a commission, his 18-year-old son, who wore glasses, who was short-sighted, and perhaps should never have been there. And he died on his first day in battle during the Battle of Loos in September of 1915. And Kipling and his wife spent the rest of their lives trying to find the body of their son. They didn't manage to achieve that in life, but now he does have a headstone in St Mary's ADS Cemetery, about a mile or so away from where he died. I think it was in the 1990s that headstone was changed from an unknown soldier to that of Jack Kipling, my boy Jack. It wasn't until 1919 that Kipling wrote a letter to the army accepting that his son was probably dead like everybody else. He'd been hoping that one day there would be a knock at the door and his young lad would be standing there, and that never happened. And it changed Kipling. Of course it did. It would have changed anybody, wouldn't it, who was a dad. He was bitter and angry about the war. He was obviously very sad. And some of his writing, it's reflected in some of his writing, how he felt when he heard that a 16-year-old sailor called Jack Cornwall had died. He wrote his famous poem, My Boy Jack. He said it wasn't about his own boy. He said it was about Jack Cornwall. But I think it's a good thing to play that poem now to remember not just his boy Jack, but the other fathers and sons that we've talked about in the podcast this week.
My boy Jack. Have you news of my boy Jack? Not this tide. When do you think that he'll come back? Not with this wind blowing and this tide. Has anyone else had word of him? Not this tide. For what is sunk will hardly swim. Not with this wind blowing and this tide. Oh dear, what comfort can I find? None this tide, nor any tide. Except he did not shame his kind, not even with that wind blowing and that tide. Then hold your head up all the more, this tide and every tide, because he was the son you bore and gave to that wind blowing and that tide.